She loves words and telling stories with and through words, whether it's words on a page, words on a stage, words over the airwaves, and now words and images combining, conversing, coming out as something much more than either alone. When we first spoke with Bathsheba Monk, we centered on her collection, Now You See It, Stories from Cokesville, Pennsylvania, a sequence of stories set in the coal and steel country she knew so well growing up. Because she loves words and has a terrific sense of humor, she probably won't mind that we'll be playing for a moment with the word underground to get us from there to here. Cokesville was shaped heavily by what went on below ground, and might still be. Take Theodore, who seems to be squandering his life digging holes in the ground and pulling out coal, as the story tells us. But Bathsheba isn't so interested in such things as industrial extraction and annealing. It's the lives like those of Theodore she cares about, and the way they've been shaped by the limited horizons of that world, even annealed in some cases. And how about underground now? We'll soon speak with Bathsheba about her recently published graphic novel titled Memories of the Year 2000. We'll find ourselves in Boston, and we know the city's reputation as a center of academic excellence and its focus in many quarters on work of the mind rather than the backbreaking work of Rust Belt towns like Cokesville. And yet, we wind up underground with a faculty member of what had been the Department of History at a famous university in Cambridge, Massachusetts. She's confined to her basement office with its stained carpet and mice with the run of the place, hired to rewrite the history of the world. Bathsheba will tell us forthrightly that she was inspired by Dostoevsky's novella, Notes from the Underground, whose narrator lives in a seedy basement apartment where he rails against intellectual formulas that would attempt to shape people in ways in which they'd no longer be individuals, but merely piano keys played by the powerful. Just speculation here, but the underground man and Bathsheba's professor might just prefer the living, breathing, eccentric characters from Cokesville, flawed but alive nevertheless, to those isolated, alienated humans the professor's employers hoped to create. Bathsheba Monk is a novelist, playwright, editor, publisher, and illustrator who lives in Allentown. She is founder and director of Blue Heron Bookworks, a small independent press focusing on memoirs and series fiction that provides editorial and writing services for its authors. And again, it is based in the Lehigh Valley. Bathsheba Monk returned to the WVIA studios to talk about her life and writing and her recent graphic novel, Memories of the Year 2000. Was writing about Cokesville something that was important for you to do before you blossomed out into other things? Did you have to get the Cokesville stories told?
Right. Yes.
So tell us, where is Cokesville and what are these stories and how are they fundamental, foundational for you as a writer?
I think every writer has to tell their origin story. I mean, they just have to get it out. That's all there is to it. And I wasn't even in this area when I wrote these stories, at least most of them. And so in a way, I sort of enchanted the area. I don't know if it deserves it or not. But I do think that every writer has to make themselves the hero of their own story. And that means you do have to enchant your environments a little bit. And so some people read it and they said, you know, growing up in the coal region and with the steel workers and stuff, our life was meaner and harder than you depicted it. And maybe I didn't see it that way. And certainly when I left this area to go to school and go into the Army, I had better memories of it. I just had, you know, I had enchanted grandmothers who now would be on Prozac. And the things that you would look at as maybe the environment of poor families, I just thought they were magical. So that's it. I had to get it out.
Well, give us an example of what you might have perceived. You mentioned your grandmother's, but a detail or something that you might have perceived as magical as a young person in this region.
Right. I think the first story in that collection, it was about somebody who was my grandfather, basically, running away, going away from this, trying to find his own way in the world, and going to a burlesque show. And when people write about areas like the coal region and Bethlehem, the steel town and stuff, they don't think that people are actually having fun. And they are. We are. And that was the thing I think I wanted to show, that you might not be living in Trump Tower, but better even, you're living with real people and you're having real fun.
And your collection that we're talking about, the Cokesville collection, was well received outside this area.
Yes, it was. I think it resonated with a lot of industrial and mining communities like Chicago and out in Wyoming and places where they had mines. And I was very surprised about that. But it seems like that life was the same there that it was here. So we have that in common. And that's one reason why I think people should write their stories, if it's fictional or memoir, is because we have more in common with each other than we don't.
And another wonderful thing about meeting you and getting to know you as a writer, Bathsheba, is that you have many different interests. You have many different things that catch your fancy. Your imagination is seemingly boundless. You love the detective story, so you have created a series and a character who is going through
solving mysteries.
Yes,
yeah.
But that's another facet of your interest as a writer.
Right. Yeah. Swanson Herbinko. And Herbinko is a family name, by the way, if you're out there, hello. You know, you can't really write about, you can only write what you know. And so she was based on a character somewhat like me, ethnically very much like me, in a town like Boston, where I was living at the time. And so her perspective on Boston and on crime and people that lived in a different social sphere than she did was the same as mine. And that's why it was such fun to write it. And I think that's why a lot of people responded to it so well, because I wasn't trying to be, you know, like Sybil Shepherd in that, you know, that TV Moonlighters or something like that. Yeah. And I wasn't trying to be that. I was trying to be just who I was, looking at the situation I found myself in at the time. And it was fun. That's why they were such fun.
And that's what we get when we read the stories. And we want to know, is that a vein that you've, pardon the pun, is that a vein that you've depleted the ore?
Well, I don't think I can ever quite deplete that, because that's the raw clay I have to work with, you know. So now I'm back in this area again after a long time away, as you know. And then I did write Nude Walker, which was about coming back to this area and how I saw it from that point of view. And then, of course, once. And I don't really think I can ever be finished with that story.
It is important for those of us who are from an area to either go ourselves away and come back and look freshly, or, in your case, count on you as a creative artist to have gone away and to come back and come to terms with what you find. Did you find different things? What did you notice newly?
Well, I found out that everybody I knew had moved away. I mean, I thought I was the only one, but obviously not. And new people had moved in. And it was interesting how it was changing. It was just, it was completely changing. Our area now in Allentown, where I live now, is like 60% Latino, which I absolutely love. And I wish my Spanish were better. And I'm working on it, believe me. And it just makes for a different feel for it. But at the same token, we're the same. I keep coming back to this over and over. We're the same. You know, across the street, there's a big Latino family. And, you know, I had a death in my family this year. And they came over and they were like, you know, you're our family now. We're your family. So it's like, wow.
We also know of your interest in the stage theater. You know some very talented actors who have taken part in
right.
productions that you've been involved in, written and mounted, and radio plays, which you did one of here. We had that wonderful time together.
It's a great experience.
Here. And that's why we're building up to getting to the graphic novel as yet a different form. You have a sense of imagining a story but you also find a form in which to tell it, and you don't squeeze everything into a short story or into a novel.
Right. Well, I think all writers, I mean, probably all artists, want to get their story, their message out there. And let's face it, the other media, people tune into the radio, people will listen to podcasts, people will go to the theater. And so that's why I tried to go down that road, just to bring the story to more people, to more different audiences, so they could understand what I was, where I live and what I was trying to express, basically.
And the stories that you would tell in these radio pieces or on the stage were an extension, a growing out of, organically related to some of what you had been doing?
Yes. Like, well, Lois's Wedding was about fracking, actually. A lighthearted musical about fracking is what I call it. So that was very much about this, the fracking. I think it's more to the west of here, but I do go there a lot and I know what it's like. But it was, you know, based on my cousin. And so it was my story, too. And a lot of people came. It was put on at the Steel Stacks. And so there was a really diverse audience that came to see it. And they all kind of got then what we were talking about, what it felt to be like you only had so many options and the main character was marrying to get out of it, basically. And so it kind of posed the question, what would you do? You know, would you stand and die with it, or would you go find your fortunes someplace else?
And again, we're sitting here in a radio studio. So tell us why you love radio. How did you begin listening to radio? When did you get the bug to write for radio?
Well, I didn't really know anything about radio until Cokesville was published. And then National NPR wanted to interview me, so I went to WDIY studio in Bethlehem. And frankly, I got the bug. It's like, I got a microphone here. And it was a great experience. And then I started doing a series of essays about change. I was interviewing other people with their essays about what change meant to them and what they accomplished in their life. Like somebody lost 100 pounds, somebody else moved across country, and what all these big changes meant, and why some people were capable of it and other people weren't. And then after that, I started interviewing other artists. And I have to admire you, Erica, because it's a lot of work to get prepared for one of these interviews and get into somebody else's head, read their books, you know, hear their music or whatever they're into. So after a while, I just gave it over to somebody else, Kate Scuffle.
Another very talented, creative artist. And she was with you, actually, when you came to do that radio drama session here at the station. Do you remember the experience? Because I thought it was such great fun. I was here in this studio, right. And you all were in the middle studio and bringing it to life.
Oh, it was great. That was a highlight of my life. And I would like to do that again. I did do another radio play with one of my friends, Scott Shirk. He's an artist, a sound artist, and he has a studio. So we went to him, and he basically, he cleaned it up, and then he threw it back on me. He said, there's audacity. You got to figure out how to do this. So I'm spending all my time now in front of a computer. And look, I'm looking at your squiggly lines there. That's what I'm looking at now, you know. And I can tell a cough when I see one.
Oh, highlight, delete.
Right.
You have a very engaging style no matter what you write, and you draw us right in. It's like you're talking with us, not at us. And in that sense, it would be really well suited if you were to write for radio, which you have done.
Right. Well, I'm a big eavesdropper, first of all. I listen to people talking when they don't know I'm listening. I like to go to coffee shops and hear what they're saying. And also listening to how different people express themselves, which is really key, I think, if you're writing for radio, because you can't be the only voice. You have to have everybody talking in their own way, whatever verbal tics they have or how they express themselves. And so if I do succeed at that, that's why. And then I do like to listen to people more than I like to talk, frankly.
We move along, and you have had a chance to write graphic novel. When did you first encounter the form, the graphic novel? Do you remember?
Well, the genesis of this is actually almost 30 years in the making. So with 2025, yeah, it was about 1995. I was living in Boston. And if you can go back that far. You know, everybody thought that Bill Gates and Michael Eisner from Disney were going to take over the world creatively and, you know, money-wise and with the internet. He was the big guy then. And so I had a friend who was living down here in the Lehigh Valley, and he was sick. He was dying of AIDS. And so I would call him up all the time to try to entertain him. And that was actually the genesis of this book. I would write a chapter or a little bit of a chapter. And it was based on Notes from Underground by Dostoevsky. The first chapter is actually almost a ripoff, but it's about a woman as the main character, so she has female problems instead of whatever that guy had, you know, liver disease or something. Then I just wrote the whole thing, just a little bit at a time, and I put it away, frankly. And I basically forgot about it because I didn't see, it was a novella, and I didn't see any market for a novella like that that was so crazy, let's face it. And so anyway, it wasn't even on disc. And then we moved about three or four years ago, and I was going through box, you know how you're going through all this stuff, trying to get rid of everything. And I found this thing, Memories of the Year 2000, and I said, what is this? Really, it just slipped my mind. And I'm reading, I thought, well, I don't think this is half bad. And so I gave it to Paul, my husband, and the editor-in-chief at Blue Heron, and I said, what do you think? And he said, I think it's great, and I think you should do something with it. And so I'm thinking, what should I do with it? What's the form that this would take? And I talked to somebody about maybe doing a film of it, but it would be way too crazy and way too, it would take a director who kind of like did everything everywhere all at once, who could do something that was that fantastical. And so I thought, well, maybe I do have an art background anyway, so maybe I can try to do something like that. And so I started to think, if I present it as like a straight story and then get some illustrations from other places, maybe it could be richer. And without actually going to the whole thing of getting a film crew together and all that stuff, which doesn't interest me at all. But, you know, I mean, you have to do it if you want to get a film done. But I just wanted to do it. Oh, I forgot to tell you this. So it wasn't on disc or on any kind of thing. It was just like basically typed. And so I found somebody who was a typist, and I didn't tell her I wrote it. I just said, you know, she needed some money. I said, would you just key this in? And she did. And when it was over, she's the one who said this would make a great graphic novel. And so I said, okay, that's it. That was it. So it was kind of a collaboration. And she's actually the model that I used for the book, for the cover and stuff. So we did collaborate quite a bit.
And that's very exciting because it is so reflective of the way the creative process works, actually, right?
Right, right.
You can't control everything. You have to be open to the serendipity.
Right, right. Yeah, that's one thing I'm very big on, because every time I open it up to other people, it just gets better.
Well, the premise is quite intriguing, and the timing is such that it holds.
It's still, that's what the thing is. People are always surprised when I said I wrote it 30 years ago. And it's like the seeds were already planted way back then for a history being rewritten and the oligarchs taking over and making themselves the owners of us. And that's really what it was. And yeah, so I'm surprised that nothing has changed. and I'm disappointed. I'm disappointed that, you know, that we haven't gotten better. Let's put it that way.
And by 1995, 30 years ago, when you were writing this, the study of history as a discipline had undergone a great shift, with questions about whose stories have been told, whose haven't, for instance. There was that sense of, let's examine this discipline of history.
Right, right. What I'm finding very disturbing right now is, even though, like, you and I had an education that included a lot more, when I became an adult and I found out certain things, like about indigenous people and what we did, about slavery and how we conducted ourselves back then as a country. And so I thought, well, we solved that problem. Now we're all learning about this. And in fact, now we're cutting it down even more. They're trying to get rid of any indication in history or in the public sphere on websites and things and in history books for children that we did anything bad. And I know that two generations down, somebody's going to go back and find out what really happened. And then, of course, we'll be gone by then. But it's like, how many times do we have to learn the same lesson? I guess that's what really infuriates me. I'd like to go forward a little bit.
And you settled on the professor as history professor because what was your instinct there?
Well, because she would know. She was, you know, she had the historical or the institutional knowledge, really, of everything that's going on. And I really admire that. I'm not an academic myself, but I really do admire people who have that kind of knowledge of what went on before and how it affected everything that's coming on now. It's like Heather Cox Richardson.
She's a history professor at Boston College and very active online.
I worship her. She just like, she says, okay, this is bad, but guess what? It happened again. It happened before, you know, in 1860 or something. And frankly, when she gets a little alarmed, I start to get alarmed. So she's my canary in the coal mine here.
What has happened to the graphic novel? Where is it gone? What's it doing? Yeah, what's it doing?
Well, I'm trying to promote it now. It's not everybody's cup of tea. A lot of people don't understand. Well, again, like the genesis of it from being from Dostoevsky and that sort of underground person that's writing about society as they see it. Right now, what I'm doing with that and what I'm trying to do, though, with all of our books, actually, in Blue Heron, is to create radio plays or little films where people can get interested in them. So it's not just talking about them, saying, you know, oh, this is great, but actually presenting scenes from it and hopefully to generate some interest in it like that.
And that takes us to Blue Heron and also the fact that you are such a generous spirit. Not only do you want your own stories to get out into the world, but you're very concerned about people who have good stories, as you've been saying we all should think about, out into the world. And it's not easy to run a publishing company, I'm sure.
No, it's not. I strongly believe that everybody should be writing their story in some, maybe just even videotaping themselves, you know, with their phone or something, asking themselves questions, not just where they went to school, but like, what made you happy? You know, answering questions that really get to the meat of who somebody is, to the heart of who they are. And I'm actually looking now for considering the climate we're living in voices that maybe won't find traditional publishing. So, you know, a point of view that a big publishing house wouldn't be interested in. I'm very interested in that story getting out. Because when I look at, nothing against the big publishers, I love them. You know, they certainly did well by me, but they still have their own point of view. They have a New York, LA point of view. And that's a fine point of view, but it's not the only point of view. So I'm just looking for others. And especially if you don't have a victim mentality, that's what I'm really interested in. I'm interested in how you see the culture. Say you're not part of the mainstream. So how do you see the culture and what are you doing to thrive in that culture? That's a story I'm interested in now. You know, I don't know if you ever heard of Sarah Schulman. She's a big voice in the LGBTQ community. And I just read something she wrote recently, and she was chastising fellow people in that community that if they got a publishing deal or they got some kind of voice, she said, just remember that the only reason that you got a voice is because you're feeding into somebody else's idea of how they're self-branding themselves. And that made a big impression on me because, yeah, it's like how they see maybe immigrants or, you know, and it's always with a slightly pitying look, which I don't like, you know.
In the past, you've brought a whole lineup of books published by Blue Heron Bookworks. A great range, a great variety. There's a trucker who's told
right.
them, tell us about the trucker, because that's another one of those voices that is a surprise, I think.
It was a shock, actually. It was a friend of a friend, and they said, this person has been writing letters home. He's a trucker for 30 years, and he's now retiring, and he's interested. He wants to see if they're any good. And so I thought, oh, okay, let me look at them. And, you know, you do it, but you're aware that not everybody can write. And by writing, I don't mean grammar and how to put a paragraph together. By knowing how to write, I mean what they observe. What are the things that they think of that are important when they're looking around, you know, to notice? And that's a, to me, that's a writer. And when I read his stories, it was like, yes, this guy, he sees the romance of the road. He sees the absurdity of having this life. And so that's why we agreed to take him on. It was, yeah. And also there was one story that didn't catch my eye, but it caught Paul's eyes. And it was about a Santa story. It was kind of a fiction story. And it was about this trucker being approached by, you know, a Santa character around Christmas. And I thought it was like a little sentimental, but Paul said, no. He said, this is like, it's tugging at my heartstrings. And so I said, okay, it's in the book too. But he was great. And it was interesting to me to hear the people in the culture that he admired that I didn't necessarily agree with, but he had a different point of view because, you know, gas prices affected him, tolls, all this stuff that I don't have to worry about necessarily. And he did because that was his livelihood. And it was interesting. Our relationship now has been like a year and a half, maybe 2 years. And it's interesting now to see how he's changed a little bit because, you know, he reads and he sees the news. And so I think we're all growing. And it's very, and this is one reason why I'm very big on communication with people who maybe don't agree with us. We really affect each other, you know, more than we know, as long as we don't call each other names.
Now, what should people do if they want to read your books, if they want to get in touch about the story that they or stories they've written that might have the kind of appeal that you've described, a fresh point of view?
Well, they can write to me. They can go to my website, you know, BathshebaMonk.com, and I have a contact page on there, and also at Blue Heron Bookworks, and they can see the kind of things that everybody in our company is writing. So there's a lot more that aren't on there now that I have to update. Yeah, so that's like the best place to see if you think you're a fit. And even if you don't, you know, surprise me. I like to be surprised.
Bathsheba Monk, novelist, playwright, editor, publisher, and illustrator. From Allentown, she is founder and director of Blue Heron Bookworks, a small independent press in the Lehigh Valley. And she's been speaking with us about her writing life, and particularly her recent graphic novel, Memories of the Year 2000, issued by Blue Heron Bookworks. So you can find all that information on her website, BathshebaMonk.com, BathshebaMonk.com, BathshebaMonk, BathshebaMonk.com, and or BlueHeronBookworks.com, BlueHeronBookworks.com.